Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I think what's happened with baby food in the last 10 years is so interesting and kind of completes the story in a very interesting way.
Amy Bentley took her time writing her new book about the invention and evolution of baby food in America. She's with us today to talk about the changing trends, a couple recipes to use up the dregs of your Thanksgiving turkey and all those potatoes you harvested from your garden, why grasslands are hot commodities for ranchers these days. Indiana rancher Dave Fisher talks about how he's cultivated relationships with local restaurants. And we have a profile of the man behind the Obama administration's agricultural policy, Tom Vilsack. Our news crew took a well-deserved break last week. Luann Johnson is back to the grind with three stories from the world of food. What you got?
In case you missed it a couple weeks ago, calorie counts on restaurant menus will become the norm under new rules from the FDA. Under a provision in the 2010 healthcare law, businesses selling fresh foods would have to post nutrition content. The requirements apply to restaurant chains with 20 or more locations, regular menu items, but not seasonal and daily specials, and prepared foods at groceries and delis. Health advocates have cheered the decision, although research from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health says only about 30% of consumers notice the calorie counts. Marion Nussel of New York University argues that labeling will force restaurants to lower calorie counts. Studies from Johns Hopkins support that. Newer menu items in chains have posted lower calorie counts than previous menu items. Climate change will raise the price tag on federal crop and flood insurance. That's the conclusion of a report from the nonpartisan Government Accountability Office, which says by the year 2100, the cost could be up to 50 to 100%. Changing crop insurance to help farmers adapt to long-term issues, though, would be expensive. Here's Iowa State University agronomist Chris Anderson.
If crop insurance were expanded to keep farmers in business for the next decade or two decades as they pay for adapting to climate change, then the exposure of public funding for that program would grow immensely.
Anderson says farmers can invest in adaptations, such as putting in new ponds, to help prevent losses. But they may not see a return on those dollars for many years. And chefs are now joining in the argument over GMO labeling on food. Chef Tom Colicchio, a judge on the reality TV show Top Chef and founder of Kraft Restaurants, authored a petition that was delivered to Congress this week. It was signed by 700 chefs. The petition is asking Congress to advance on GMO labeling legislation, saying, quote, "As chefs, we know that choosing the right ingredients is an absolutely critical part of cooking. But when it comes to whether our ingredients contain genetically modified organisms, we're in the dark," unquote. This comes in the same week as officials in Oregon begin the recount of the state's GMO labeling ballot measure. Measure 92 was defeated by less than a tenth of a percentage point, or 812 votes. Election officials have until December 12th to complete the recount. Keep an eye out on our Twitter feed to see what happens with the Oregon recount. Stay up on all the latest food and farm news by following @EarthEats.
And we should always direct you to our website as well, where you can share links to these stories, eartheats.org. Luann Johnson, always a pleasure.
It's good to be back, Annie.
The U.S. beef herd is smaller than it's been in decades, thanks to drought and low cattle prices. But Midwest ranchers are eager to grow, and that has turned grass into a hot commodity. Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach has the story.
Boss!
Dave Wright is calling in the cows.
It's come boss. Come boss, but you get lazy and just, boss, right?
Boss!
We're on his ranch near Ewing in north central Nebraska, where he and his son Isaac graze around 400 cows and their calves. The national beef herd is down to the size it was in 1951, and Wright has noticed the same thing you probably have in the grocery store. Beef is more expensive, which has people switching to chicken and pork. To raise more cattle and perhaps bring down meat prices, ranchers need more pasture. The trouble for many ranchers is grass has grown expensive. Dave Wright drives me to the edge of his ranch, bouncing over snowdrifts and yucca plants. We get out of the truck to look at a neighboring pasture.
Kind of looks like this one, only it's on that side of the fence, you know. You know, the grass isn't necessarily greener over there. It's still grass.
But when it sold last year, you would have thought it was prime real estate. Wright went to the auction, hoping to pick up one section or another, but he couldn't compete.
In 2000, you know, I had bought pasture for $200 an acre. And in 2013, this pasture here that we're looking at across the fence over there sold for $1,500 an acre. Just an incredible, incredible price.
Pasture prices have been booming, especially in states like Kansas and the Dakotas, or Nebraska, where a state survey showed the value of grazing lands went up 24% last year, around 40% in some parts. Cropland is still more valuable, but Mike Fritz, editor of the Farmland Investor Letter, says pasture is catching up for a couple reasons.
So Mike, call it a perfect storm where you have less grass available, and now there's a time where there's a lot of competition both to get control of grass, either buying it or releasing it.
Before we talk about competition, let's cover why there's less grass. Mike Fritz says you can trace it to the boom in corn prices. Across the Midwest, millions of acres of grassland were plowed under to raise crops.
See, a lot of this land that has been converted to cropland was marginal land. You know, it has sloping soils or poor soils that aren't really productive for crops. So when prices are really high for grains, it's probably more profitable to grow crops on it.
More corn and soybeans means less grass for cows, and it's right at the time when ranchers want to expand. Drought caused ranchers to cull their herds, pushing up prices for remaining cattle. Now many ranchers are grabbing up grass to raise more calves to sell next year, calves that might show up at Richard Shrunk's sale barn. Shrunk runs the Shamrock Livestock Market in O'Neill, Nebraska.
Never, probably in the history of the cattlemen, have they made as much money as they've made right now. Calves bringing probably, you know, average $1,500, you know, per calf, you know. It wasn't too long ago, you know, a $700-$800 calf was quite a calf, you know. And they're making double that.
Shrunk handles some real estate on the side. He subleases pasture he rents from local landowners.
I have people call me all the time wanting grass. I mean, I wouldn't know how many acres I could rent if I had it. It would be unbelievable how much you could rent out.
And all that interest is bidding up prices. There are places where the cattle herd has more room to grow. You can start with Texas and Oklahoma. They cut back herd numbers by the millions because of drought. They'll bounce back as pastures recover. But ranchers like Dave Wright are selling calves at the highest prices of their careers. At a time when you would think he's banking profits, that's not necessarily the case.
We have a lot of money come in our hands, and we have a lot of money exit our hands. The trick is to, how do we get some of it to stay in our pocket?
You may be paying more than you're used to for that hamburger. That's how ranchers feel about what they're paying for pasture. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
In the second half of the show today, a profile of Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack. It took Amy Bentley 19 years to write her book, Inventing Baby Food. She worked on it sporadically as she was raising her kids. They served as guinea pigs for her field research, she says. She fed them commercial baby food and organic food and some baby food she made at home. She says this made her more empathetic to women of every era who also looked for the healthiest, the most convenient, and the most affordable way to feed their babies. Her kids are all grown up now, so it was time to finish the book. And she's glad she waited so long.
I think what's happened with baby food in the last 10 years is so interesting and kind of completes the story in a very interesting way.
Amy Bentley is also an associate professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. She stopped by the Earth Eats studios this fall. And starting on page 10, you have this graph here that sort of sets up the entire argument for the book. I found myself referring back to this over and over. And what it shows is at what age babies were first given solid foods. Starts in 1880, and they're 11 months in age. And then it goes to 2000, and we see that babies are 5 months average when they get solid food. Summarize what you're trying to tell us with how the trends change over the years.
Yeah. The graph is telling because it starts in the late 1800s, as you said, and babies are first given solid foods about 9 to 12 months of age, sort of when teeth appear. It was thought that, you know, that was an appropriate time to start solids. And the first foods were soft foods, gruels, beef broth, scraped beef. There wasn't really a category called baby food. There was just this category of soft food that was designed for babies, invalids, sick people, anybody who needed sort of a softer, blander diet. Those were the first foods that were given at that time, 9 to 12 months. When you get the rise of industrialization, the manufacturing and proliferation of baby food, then that age of introduction of solids starts to decline. And between the 1920s and the 1950s, it just sharply drops. So by the post-World War II era, the average age of introducing solids was 4 to 6 weeks.
We're talking about the 1950s and 60s, and you're right. At this point, infants are getting solid food at an average of 2 months, which is the earliest that they've gotten it on this grid.
Yeah.
So now the pushback comes in the 70s. So we're thinking consumer activism is starting to happen. The beginning of the food movement is starting to come around. This idea of natural motherhood and making your own baby food. Describe what you mean by natural motherhood.
This is part of the whole counterculture 70s that is exploring new alternative ways to live, and food is one of the things they're exploring. And so in the early part of the 20th century, the ethos was a scientific motherhood, and that was you are not capable of taking care of your child without the realm of science and the world of experts. But in the 1970s, you have a different ethos, and that this ethos is what's called natural motherhood, and that this is the exact opposite. Trust your own instincts, distrust science, distrust the experts. And so food is one of the things that where this is played out. And so a lot of people are seeing the commercial baby food as unhealthy and so are turning to making their own as the alternative.
You would think that after everything that we've been talking about, backlash in the 70s, now the food movement is in full effect right now. You'd think that commercial baby food, as you know, they knew it in the 30s, would be long gone. Not so. In 2011, Americans spent $6.2 billion on baby food. That's a figure from your book. Gerber had 3/4 of that market share. But now we're seeing some small-scale baby food manufacturers come on the scene. Let's talk about these new players and how they're changing the game.
Yeah. In the 2000s, before the recession in 2008, there were several small startup companies, and it was the right time for them to produce a different kind of baby food. They were dissatisfied by what they saw the general commercial manufacturers making. Taste was important for the first time. And so many are turning to homemade. So there's definitely a big strain and ethos to make your own baby food. But many still wanted the convenience of commercial baby food. And so you have small boutique baby food companies.
I don't know when the last time you were at a baby food aisle of a grocery store, but can you talk about the different sorts of flavors and dishes that they're offering now?
Yeah. Well, one of the biggest changes is the delivery system, which is the pouch. And so you can open the top and you can squeeze the baby food out on a spoon and feed it to your baby, or you can just hand it to your child and the child can squeeze it and glug it down themselves. And that's a logical extension of the jar. So it's even a more convenient delivery system for baby food. The flavors are more unique. So you've got quinoa and kale and kiwi flavors. Wow. You've got barley and salmon and amaranth. So they're trying to definitely appeal to a more cosmopolitan palette of flavors. You know, they're doing very well. And the commercial baby food manufacturers are following suit.
I want to one last time go back to our grid on page 10. So it stops at 2000. I don't suppose we know the average age at which infants are getting solid foods for 2010. Do we know that yet?
Well, the advice is 4 to 6 months.
Which is still where it is.
Yeah. And that has not really changed. However, I think what's happening today is something really interesting. The practice that's been in favor for a while is introduce food slowly, one at a time, wait a week in between foods and check for food allergies. And some pediatricians are saying, if you wait and introduce foods 1 week at a time, the kid's going to be, you know, 15 months old before they've had kind of a decent array of foods. Better to introduce foods earlier and more frequently and help further promote that palate development for a wide variety of flavors, tastes, and textures than to wait. It's really an interesting potential reversal of introducing solids, and we'll kind of see where it plays out.
Amy Bentley is the author of Inventing Baby Food, Taste, Health, and the Industrialization of the American Diet. More from this interview is at eartheats.org. Coming up, the logistics of getting local meat onto local menus.
You know, Rags might want to add 50 cents to make it cost okay for him for a burger. I think a lot of people are willing to pay an extra 50 cents.
Rancher Dave Fisher and restaurateur Greg Rago talk about how they make it work for both of their bottom lines. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Hello, it's Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Let's get cooking with Daniel Orr, a traditional British dish called bubble and squeak. 3 ingredients for this one, some fat of some sort, potatoes, and...
You would normally just add cabbage, but we're going to use some Brussels sprouts. And then we're going to stir it with a little bit of... You could use bacon fat, you could use butter, you could use olive oil, and it will actually squeak and bubble in the pan. That's why they call it bubble and squeak. All right, so for the Brussels sprouts, I just slice them. And then steam them off quickly. You could blanch them in boiling water and then shock them with cold water so they keep that really nice color. So our butter's nice and hot. We add the potatoes. You can hear it kind of sizzling. And then when that cabbage starts to really heat up, it'll give a little squeak. All right, so what you're getting is you're starting to get a little bit of brown. Give it a little taste. I love this stuff. And there's nothing more late wintry than that.
Daniel has a recipe for stew coming up today as well. Rancher Dave Fisher has developed relationships with area restaurants. They buy his products directly from him. Back when he was starting out, he went door to door, meeting people in charge of purchasing at restaurants. He would usually drag along one of his kids. One of the first doors he knocked on was Nick's English Hut. Greg Rago answered.
Everybody calls you Rags. My title is I'm a managing partner, owner of Nick's English Hut. It's kind of an interesting story that Dave and I met. We always bought our meat from Ferris Market. We bought beef there for years. Dave came by as a cold call, just walking from restaurant to restaurant, wanting to know if I wanted to buy his beef. And I said, well, Dave, I really appreciate what you're doing. I'd never met him before, but a super nice guy. And I said, Dave, I've been buying meat. We've been buying meat here for 60 years from the Ferris Market. I really just can't stop buying from him. He understood, but we know we kind of had, we always kept in contact. And then literally overnight, several months later, Ferris Market went out of business, which we had no clue that was going to happen. So scrambling around, my wife and I was trying to figure out what to do. And so light bulb came on, let's call Dave Fisher. And Dave said, sure, I'll work with you. We'll do the best. They'll do the best they can. And the rest is history. So I guess we're proud to say we're probably one of his first big customers, and we're very happy with it.
Now they collaborate on the Nick's Burger, a special blend developed by Fisher and Sander Processing just for Rags' restaurant. They also offer Fisher steaks on their menu. They use their beef and pork for their chili, ground turkey for their turkey burgers, brisket and pork loin. All this totals up to 500, 600 pounds of meat per week.
Well, it's kind of, I think, what all of us really want to do when you have an independent, smaller restaurant, even our restaurant seats 400 people, where you can trust the person that is raising your beef and processing your beef.
And as a chef, he says it keeps him creative. The way it works from Fisher's end is chefs call him up or text him on Mondays to place their orders. Then he sends that order sheet to Sander Processing, which receives the animals and then prepares all the ribeyes and sausages. Deliver the orders to the restaurants, and that meat will probably get to customers' plates by that same Friday. The challenge Fisher faces is selling all parts of the animal.
You know, I've got so much ribeye, so much filet, so much strip steak, so much sirloin, and so forth each week, and I've got to figure out which restaurants those are going to.
Which is what makes his relationship with Rags and Nick's English Hut so special.
You know, I'll call him up and say, you know, I am just swimming in sirloin. Can you put a sirloin on your menu? And they've been super to do that.
So week in and week out, Nick's might change their specials based on what extra cuts they get from Fisher. Since Nick's tries to keep its food under $20 a plate, it's the customers who might benefit the most from this setup.
What I've been seeing is that our high-end steaks are generally in high-end restaurants where it's $40 and $50 a plate. But our burgers are higher than the conventional market, but you know, if Rags might want to add 50 cents, to make it cost okay for him for a burger, I think a lot of people are willing to pay an extra 50 cents.
That's one Fisher product you're absolutely guaranteed to see on Nick's menu every single day. The burger is definitely one of their best sellers.
It's a 80% protein, 20% fat blend. Their fat is very natural. It's got like a buttery type flavor. Their meat has an excellent grain to it. Any steak that you have has great marbling, which means it's a great combination of fat and protein together, which gives it a very unique flavor. Also,
Chef Greg Rags Rago and Farmer Dave Fisher. More stories like this at eartheats.org. The U.S. Department of Agriculture isn't just for farmers. It also supports school lunches, broadband internet access in rural areas, and inner-city farmers markets. As Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports, that diverse mandate fits with the man running it all, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, who's now been on that job longer than anyone since the Nixon administration.
Tom Vilsack grew up in the city, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
If my parents were alive today and knew I was the Secretary of Agriculture, they would think that there was something seriously wrong with the country.
In college, he met his wife, and after he finished law school, they settled in her hometown in rural southeast Iowa. As a small-town lawyer here in Mount Pleasant, Iowa, during the farm crisis of the 1980s, Vilsack's commitment to rural America was born and grew. Early on, he raised money to build ball fields in Iowa. Now, he's overseeing that kind of development across the country.
I'm very proud of the work that's been done in rural development. The ability to create a strategy for rebuilding and revitalizing the rural economy.
Vilsack has expanded USDA's support for non-farm programs, such as rural broadband, microlending for entrepreneurs, and telemedicine. Chris Merritt, director of the Illinois Institute for Rural Affairs, says funding for rural development projects started to grow in the 90s.
And then definitely in the 2008 and then the most recent farm bill, we've seen, I would say diversification of the programs that are in that rural development set of initiatives.
Funding is still a tiny fraction of the overall farm bill, but in this climate of budget cuts, rural development's getting a six-fold increase next year. Merritt says that reflects Vilsack's priorities.
He sort of believes in the importance of rural America, farming, yes, but more broadly rural America.
Vilsack's a Democrat, but he's widely credited with rallying the support that ultimately made the 2014 Farm Bill one of the few major bipartisan successes in this Congress. That ability to work across party lines doesn't surprise the folks who knew him back in small-town Iowa.
I'd rather he'd been president. Quite honestly.
That's Paul Dennison, owner of a local Mount Pleasant radio station.
Tom and I are not members of the same political party.
And yet Dennison has supported Vilsack's political rise, including in his first bid for governor.
He needed some money, quite honestly, and I would have given him whatever he asked for.
Dennison says, of course, he'd like to see more federal dollars coming into Mount Pleasant, but Vilsack does maintain ties to this community. Near Mount Pleasant, Kurt Garrettson stokes a wood stove in the farmhouse on one of the oldest continuously operated family farms in Iowa. USDA programs have helped him put in a new pond and also support his interest in specialty crops like elderberries and grapes.
I ran for political office 2 years ago, and I mean, they donated to my campaign. I didn't even ask them. They did that.
Like the Vilsacks, Garrettson's a Democrat in Republican territory.
Whenever he came through, they were always willing to do photo shoots and were always very friendly.
You really feel a bond and you feel a debt to the people who give you these opportunities. And so this position gives me a chance to continue to repay that debt.
Still, it's a partisan job. Vilsack has faced criticism, for example, over new school nutrition requirements trumpeted by Michelle Obama. But he's one of just two original cabinet secretaries in office since the beginning of the Obama presidency. And he's led USDA longer than any other ag secretary since 1969.
When you have an historic opportunity, you should relish it, you should cherish it, and you should do the best you can at it.
He's got two more years with the current administration. Vilsack says he hopes to use them to focus more attention and resources on child poverty in rural areas. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
More stories about agriculture in the Midwest at harvestpublicmedia.org. Hands up. Who still has leftover turkey from Thanksgiving? Anybody? Anybody? How about you make a stew with it? Daniel Orr is starting with some quinoa.
I like to cook them and use them as stuffings and omelets or to stuff peppers instead of the typical rice. But you can also mix it into soups. And that's one of the things that I've done for you today. Made a little soup. I had some smoked turkey broth, put the quinoa in there, some carrots, some collard greens. You could throw leeks, you could throw turnips, you could throw parsnips, anything you want in there. And then the kumquats, the little oranges that are in there, give it a really fun, interesting flavor and make it very different. And they have a nice citrus pop as you eat them. So kumquat has kind of a sweet but a touch of bitterness to it. But I think it really goes well with the smokiness of the turkey. It's a way to add excitement to those kind of late winter dishes.
If you do make this recipe, don't skimp on the kumquats. They are these little flavor bullets in the stew. So good. EarthEats.org is the place to find this recipe and everything you heard in today's show. Our Earth Eats team is Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, Casey Zakin, and the folks at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Good times. Thanks for being a part of it today. I'm Annie Corrigan.